If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Court Appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Tommy Smurl, and I am just a dude.
Well, I think this episode airs on January 1st, 2018.
Happy New Year. And you know what doesn't change in the new year?
What's that?
Greed, Michael. Greed. All out greed.
Greed is good, according to Gordon Gekko, I
think. Yeah, if you want a friend, get a dog. But greed, corporate greed, it's my pet peeve. I've been on it before. This isn't the first time. I'm climbing back up on that soapbox. Our good friends at Apple. You know, the only person that probably has more money than Apple is God. But how much is enough? Do you know? How much is enough, Michael?
I don't know. I mean, I have some money. I keep it in a jar. It's buried in my backyard. One day I hope to have more. But
you know, of all the people, Apple is making money hand over fist. I mean, they've got so much they don't even know what to do. They're building gardens and playgrounds and crap like that because they don't know what to do with all the money they got. But yet they need more. So they push out an update that sabotages your phone. If you don't have the most up-to-date model, you don't have your iPhone 10, they're trying to get you to upgrade. So they push out an update that slows down your phone and shortens your battery life and throttles down your messaging and everything else. So that then they tell you, well, you know, we told you that if you don't keep up, you're going to lose, you're going to have problems with your phone. Yeah, we're going to make you have problems. We're going to sabotage your phone.
That seems pretty fraudulent and disingenuous, if you ask me.
That's exactly right. And you know what? It's the corporation. It's Apple. Oh, they issued an apology. Don't we all feel better? There was an apology. They said, oh, we're sorry if you experienced some of that. We would never knowingly do that. As a matter of fact, we're going to drop the price of our replacement batteries from $79 down to $29 just to help you out. If you need a new battery to keep your phone going. Well, that's really generous of them there to drop it down. They probably cost them a nickel to start with. So, you know, they're really cutting into their profits there. But here's the thing. Somebody somewhere in that company made the decision, we are going to screw our customers. We are going to deceive them. We're going to commit fraud, and we're going to make them think they need an upgrade they don't need, and therefore we get more money out of it. But you know who's going to answer for it?
This is a rhetorical question.
Well, I was hoping you would give me a no one or something.
No one.
That's right. No one. You nailed it. No one will answer for it. It's just the company. Maybe they might come out and fine them. Okay. So they pay a little bit of money. It doesn't matter. But somebody, people, human beings made that decision. They hide behind the face of the corporation and they won't be punished.
Well, that's why we have to have class action lawsuits.
Well, I agree. A class action lawsuit, but
even though it's a small amount of the benefit that gets passed on to whoever prevails in these class action lawsuits, you know, a couple dollars here and there, it adds up when you have a large amount of people. And even though the lawyers are the ones who make out the best, at least
the company's having to pay a lot.
Yeah,
and it hurts. And maybe they'll think about it next time.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, what do they do? Oh, they might sacrifice one person. Oh, yeah, we had this one guy over here, and he did that all on his own, so we're going to fire him. And then they write him a check for a few hundred million when he goes out the door, so he keeps his mouth shut and takes the blame and lives off of his hundreds of millions. But they need to pass a law where people are held responsible, and they're either facing prison sentences or fines or something as individuals. And also, companies should be forbidden from giving these golden parachutes to people that leave the company because of fraudulent or criminal activities.
Yeah, I agree. I think they should give them a golden shower.
Yeah, I'll say something. They need some kind of shower.
Well, there's a lot of disparity with CEOs and things like that. I think we've talked about it before about the amount of money that CEOs make and compared to your average worker at a business or a corporation. So it's not really a level playing field.
No, it's not. And also these things, there is nothing to deter these companies from continuing to commit fraud against us innocent consumers.
Well, I don't think there's going to be any law that does what you want to happen anytime soon, though.
Well, the problem is that we can't pass a law that goes back and makes them responsible.
That's true. For the most part, you can't.
If we could, I don't know what you'd call a law like that, but if we could, I would do it.
What, pass a law that goes backwards?
Yeah, and makes people accountable for things that they've done wrong.
Well, there is a term for that, actually.
There is.
It's ex post facto.
Ipso facto defecto?
No, it's basically like a legal term. And ex post facto law basically means that it makes something that is a legal act whenever it was legal when actually committed, and increases penalties for an infraction after it's been committed. And basically, that kind of law is actually not allowed in the United States. So there's nothing we can actually do to make that happen, unfortunately, with regards to these things. We basically would have to punish them under the scheme that existed at the time whenever these things were committed.
And it's not permitted as provided by the U.S. Constitution.
That's right. It protects us and protects them.
Well, we need to examine it. I think there's some times where it needs to be done, and corporate fraud is one of them.
Well, what you have to have, you would have to have a new law passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate and brought into and signed by the president in order to change those kinds of laws. So,
well, and it would actually have to be a constitutional amendment, wouldn't it?
No, I mean, to change the ability to change laws retroactively, yeah, yes. It has to be a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
I'm talking about, that's not going to happen. We're not going to change that.
No, we're not going to.
No.
I know, but I mean, so they're outlawed here. You can't do one.
No, you can't do that. So basically, you'd have to have a new law which would prohibit the kind of stuff that you're talking about. And basically, whenever we were talking about doing an episode on new laws and things like that, it always makes me think of the old Schoolhouse Rock. You remember that?
Like become a bill?
Yeah, how a bill becomes a law.
I'm just a dude, just a know-nothing dude. That's where that song came from.
Oh, yeah. From what episode was that from?
That was a few episodes back. Remember, we had one of our people write in and say that he every time he heard me say that, he thought of that song. So that's where we came from. He wrote that song off of it. He wrote the song, I'm just a dude, remember?
I don't, actually.
And I sang it on one of our episodes. I'd have to go back in the archives and look to see which one.
The court-appointed archives?
Yeah. I might still remember it, but it's not worth it. I won't try it.
But that Schoolhouse Rock, you remember there was the little Bill that was sitting on the steps, and basically he had a little song and dance about how basically a bill becomes a law?
Yeah, how he gets to go he goes into committee, and then he gets voted on in the House, and then he goes in committee and gets voted on in the Senate, and
yep.
Then he has to be signed by the president.
Exactly. Now, the one thing that comes into play is that whether or not when this bill actually becomes a law and when it goes into effect. So a president might sign it or a governor might sign off on it, because basically, regardless whether it's going to be the federal level or the state level, the process is going to be pretty much exactly the same. You have the legislative branch and then you have the executive branch. So the legislative branch essentially proposes legislation. And then the executive branch is the one that actually signs it into law. But now, when do these laws come into effect? Now, common sense, you'd think, oh, January 1st. But that's actually almost always not true.
Almost always.
Almost always. The only way a law generally becomes effective on January 1st in most of the states is if it is specifically written into the law that it takes effect on January 1st. Usually, most states have some sort of provision where essentially it'll come into play at some point a certain amount of days after the expiration of the current term of the legislature or the House.
Well, I know that in West Virginia, a lot of them take effect July 1st. because they are on a fiscal calendar that runs from July 1st through June 30th.
Right. And basically the way West Virginia law reads is that no act of the legislature shall take effect until the expiration of 90 days after its passage, unless the legislature shall, by a vote of 2/3 of the members elected to each house, taken by yeas and nays, otherwise direct.
So in other words, they're saying, like, if they pass something that was so urgent it needed to take effect immediately, they could do the yeas and nays, and if they got enough yeas, they'd say, yay, it counts right now?
Yay! It counts right now.
Boo! I'm against it.
Now, like you said, it usually does happen in the summer because that has that falls in line as to when the 90 days expiration, whenever it's passed. Now, the one thing that is coming into law on January 1st this year in West Virginia is this new voter ID law. Have you been reading about that?
No, I have not.
So basically now, in order to vote in West Virginia, you actually have to have some form of identification to vote in West Virginia.
I thought they had struck all those things down and said that they were discriminatory or something.
Well, those were ones that basically said you had to have a driver's license to vote and things like that. Now, this new law in West Virginia actually says that it doesn't have to have a, you don't have to have a photo ID. It could be a bunch of different things. And it listed off this huge amount of different things you could use from
A library card?
I think a library card may have been on there. It was any kind of benefit you might get from the state, like any kind of.
Heck, that's 9/10 of the people in West Virginia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I don't really have a problem with it because when you come in somewhere and you say, hey, I'm Michael Meadows, I'm here to vote. And they say, all right, Michael Meadows, go over there and vote. They're just like,
I agree with you. I mean, I go in there and just say, what's your name? And you tell them your name. I could be telling them anything. Yeah. You live on so-and-so? Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, it's a little scary if you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I really don't mind them asking me. And I have heard people complain that that will keep people from voting. They use the term disenfranchise.
Right.
That's a big word. To me, just being asked to show my driver's license or some form of ID that has my name on it, I don't think that's too much to ask. But I guess for some people that would be hard.
Well, the way they wrote this, I mean, there is no way that somebody exists in this state and does not have one of these things. I mean, it would not be plausible.
So like you could just bring a bill that you have or
yep,
something with your name on it?
Utility bill. I mean, it was like a very broad amount of things. Hmm. I think any kind of disenfranchising that may go on is vastly outweighed by the prohibition against voter fraud, which is another big word that I don't really like either. So,
well, you know, they said they found out that's how they knew that Elvis Presley was dead.
How's that?
They found him on a voter log in Logan County here in West Virginia. So they knew he was dead because most of the people that vote in Logan County are dead.
Yes, that's a kind of a running joke here in West Virginia is that basically the southern part of the state has notoriously a lot of deceased people on the voter registration rolls that come in and still actively vote.
Yes, so. They, by proxy.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say down there, vote early, vote often.
Vote early and often, that's right. There's only 300 people in the town, and the mayor won by 500 votes.
So, yeah, that was one thing that is coming into effect in West Virginia. And that's one law that probably is not going to change. I mean, it will change a little bit of things because people are going to have to bring something with them to the polls. But sometimes laws can have a big effect on different kinds of lawsuits and things based upon when actually the law goes into effect, because sometimes you might already have a law on the books and they're simply changing it around and amending something that they thought maybe had some sort of problem with it. Now, I touched on this when we were doing our live episode with Sawbones, is that because we were talking about Home Alone.
Correct.
And Home Alone came out in, I think, 1998, if I remember from my notes.
I think that's what you said.
And the Illinois law, because Home Alone took place in Chicago, the Illinois law that I was looking at, I think, was basically 2004 was when this law was written, and it talked about defensive homes. So that was the thing.
You wouldn't be able to apply that law.
That's right. This law actually wouldn't apply to 1998 Kevin Mitchell in his defense of his home.
Even if he was being tried in 2005.
That's right.
Because that's not when the act took place.
That's right.
Because a lot of these things take a long time from the time they happen till the time you actually go to court.
Yep.
You're looking at years.
Yeah, and that's one of the terms that they use is whenever like the cause of action accrued. And by cause of action, I mean a fact or facts that enable a person to bring an action against another.
When the full paint can first hit the skull.
Yes, when the full paint can first made the indentation. Or when Joe Pesci's head should have been melting off, as Sidney said, because of the temperature.
Because of the torch.
Yeah.
Yeah, just burn a hole in a stocking cap. That's all a blowtorch would do to your head.
I want to talk a bit more about these important different differences when laws go into effect. But I think before that, we have our first motion of the new year.
We do. Well, might it please the judge that I approach the bench, pay for court costs.
All right. Well, who do we have on the docket first?
Well, first on the docket is our good friends from Sleep Number. Making New Year's resolutions is one thing. Sticking to them is another. Whether it's resolving to get to the gym more or eating sweets less, those are all things on my list, there's one thing that can help make sure you sleep well. Most Americans get less than the recommended 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. If that's you, science proves getting more sleep will make it easier to hold fast to your goals.
The Sleep Number bed lets you choose your ideal comfort and support on each side. It's the perfect bed for couples. Their newest beds are so smart, they actually sense your every move and automatically adjust so you stay sleeping comfortably throughout the night. They even have an adjustment for snoring. Does your bed do that, Tommy?
My bed does not do that. My CPAP machine does, as I've mentioned before. It mutes my snoring. But if I didn't have one, that would be a good thing. And it might help Mary, because sometimes I catch her snoring.
Do you now?
Yeah.
I don't think you should mention that on the podcast.
Okay. Well, just forget you heard that. Nobody listens anyway, do they?
I don't know.
I hope they do.
I hope they do for our advertiser's sake.
Just don't tell Mary.
Yeah, just don't tell Mary about it. I'll tell you what, after the holidays, I think I need a good night's sleep because it's been a hectic run.
It has been very hectic. I've been worn out about every morning I woke up till today. Today was about the first day I felt caught up.
I had to get back to work today. I didn't enjoy that too much.
Well, I've been going back to work the whole time.
Well, this is my little bit of time off, but it kind of wore me out. I did a bunch of stuff around the house and tried to get caught up on things, but didn't really.
Well, that's about the way I look at vacation. I come back from vacation and go to work so I can catch up on my rest.
I had a stack of papers about, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches deep on my desk that I had to sort through.
Well,
so what I'm trying to say is you need a good bed to get a good night's sleep after the holidays.
And Sleep Number beds are the bed to do that.
They are. Don't miss the best bed for couples at the lowest prices of the season. Come in now and save $400 to $700 on the most popular Sleep Number mattresses.
You'll only find Sleep Number at sleepnumber.com/court or any of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide.
So do yourself a favor and check out Sleep Number. So now, as I was saying, it's very important to determine when a law becomes into effect because it can have a lot of ramifications on your case as a lawyer.
Well, I can understand that. There's one right now that's out there that a lot of people are concerned with, and I think they're a little confused.
What's that?
The new tax law.
Yeah.
A lot of people are running around saying, what is it going to do to me? What is it going to do to me? Well, yes, it may affect you, but it's not going to affect you this year. You're going to file your taxes this year just like you have always done. Everything's still the same. It doesn't take effect till next year's taxes.
Right.
At the end of 2018 is when you would see the changes. Now, there are some things like property taxes that people are saying, can I pay these early and gain some advantage because I may not be able to deduct them next year? But other than that, next year is when you got to worry about this change.
Well, basically, unless I misunderstood, when it takes effect is that anything, any taxable event that accrues during the year 2018 would be subject to the new tax law.
Right.
But it does, you know, it's not pay and doable or whatever. You don't have to, I guess, come clean with the government until 2019 for the 2018 tax year.
Well, but what they're talking about is property taxes are going to have a cap on them. Before, property taxes were all deductible.
Mm-hmm.
Now they got a $10,000 cap on them. So in some of these high tax states, you have people that are paying $25,000 in property taxes. Now they can only claim $10,000 at $25,000. So what they're saying is, now not all states allow you, but some of them allow you to pay your property taxes ahead. So you'd be better off to pay the extra $15,000 this year and deduct it off of this year's income, because next year you're just going to lose it.
Right. So go ahead and get as much of it as you can.
Yeah. But now some states don't let you pay it ahead, so you can't do it.
Right. And that whole theory is predicated, and this is kind of off the script a little bit, but I think it's based on taxable event. And that's one of the things you look at. It's almost similar to a cause of action type theory. And that's one thing you always look at whenever you're doing tax work, is you see when the taxable event happens.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if you earn income today, which would be 2017, the taxable event would have occurred in 2017. Whereas if you get it on January 1st, the taxable event happens on 2018. So that's when that happened. So
it's under the new law.
Under the new law, which is very similar. And people always told me this when I was growing up because I was born on December 31st.
Right.
And, you know, as far as
you were a nice little tax deduction.
Exactly. It was like, oh, I get a tax deduction. So basically the benefit of that was that you didn't really have a reason, have any expenses for the child, allegedly.
But you got the full deduction.
But you get the full deduction for it. So, yeah. Yeah. It's a little, I was a special little kid.
Yeah. I was rooting for Taylor to make it before the end of the year. And she was born January 13th. So
yeah,
she, you know, missed by a couple weeks.
Well, that's the opposite effect.
I know. I had her for the full year before I got the.
But that's kind of the same theory as cause of action, taxable events, things like that. Sometimes it can make a big difference on when those dates fall. And especially whenever you're talking about whenever a law goes into effect. So basically, whenever you research a law, whenever you have a case or something like that, you want to look at the actual statutory law that guides it or whatever you're looking at. And so when you go into that law, it's always the first thing you want to do is you want to match up when that law went into effect versus whenever your cause of action accrued or whatever other type of event you're looking at under that law. Because if it doesn't match up, then you're looking at the wrong law, you're going to have some egg on your face later on because somebody will figure it out eventually for the most part.
Mm. You don't want to walk around with egg on your face.
No. I had one case actually, and this is several years ago. And when I researched it, the opposing party was relying on a newer law that actually was more beneficial to them, but technically did not apply because of the date of the actual accident itself. So I had filed a motion for summary judgment, and it was based on the correct law. And I had to actually do some legislative history to research that as well because it was a very specific little issue. The law that applied in this particular case actually only existed in that form for 1 year because they had changed it 1 year. Well, they had one law that was in effect, and they changed it to do something different 1 year, and then said, "Nah, we don't like that. We're going to change it a different way," and change it again. So it just so happened.
But it happened in that niche year.
In that one niche year, and I happened to notice it, and you know, argue the one thing there. The weird thing too is because it was such a little small little niche issue in that one niche year that there wasn't any case law on it either. So I actually had to pull the committee notes, and you can actually, when you're looking doing legislative history research, you can pull committee notes and see what they talked about in committee. And you can use that to help interpret why a law was written a certain way because of what they discussed. And you can argue.
So
what,
if they're saying this law is important because of this happening, and then you can turn around and say, see, this is what they were trying to protect, and this is exactly what befell my client.
Yeah, you can say this is the legislative intent of this. Now, there's a whole hierarchy of arguments whenever you're doing legal research and legal writing. And legislative intent is pretty much one of the lower ones because usually you want to rely on case law. But if there's not case law, then all you have left is the legislative intent. So,
kind of. Well, hire Mike Meadows as your attorney. He pays attention to the details pre-post-facto.
Pre-post-facto?
Yeah. It's not ex-post-facto.
Now, I said I was filing a motion for summary judgment. Do you know what that is?
That means pay it all right now and just admit you're wrong.
No. A motion for summary judgment means that basically there's no question of facts. It's purely kind of a legal argument. And they're sometimes called an MSJ, if you're using just a quick little acronym. And basically you ask the court to say that the other party has no case because there are no facts at issue. And that the party who makes the motion is claiming that the case should not go to before a jury because the jury could only rule in favor of the moving party. And there's no issues of questions of fact or anything like that. It's like the law is clear. Here are the facts.
It's kind of like my mind's made up. Don't confuse me with facts.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, if you have a case where everybody's stipulated to the facts, you know, we can say, for example, my case, the one I did where there was that one specific issue where the law changed that 1 year, and they were filing the lawsuit based on the newer law. Mm-hmm. Well, if the older law basically said you can't file a lawsuit for this kind of incident that takes place, but they filed under the new, they've already set out their facts in their complaint saying here's what's
wrong.
Place. And I'll agree to it. I'll say, yeah, it's not a question of facts. I agree with all their facts. It's a question of law.
They're using
the wrong law, and here's what should apply. So, or if you have case law that's really on point, too, that says that basically there should be no question as to how a jury would find this case. That basically, it's just it's an issue of law, essentially. So if you have a really strong case law, you can sometimes win motion for summary judgments as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So do your homework, boys and girls.
Yeah, a lot of times the cases where you can win on summary judgment, too, are these cases where you have the releases we've talked about before. If you have somebody who signed a release.
And then they file a motion, and you say, look, they signed the release. End of story.
Yeah, there's no question. We're not even disputing it. We're not even talking about the fact that this incident took place. They signed a release.
It says right in here that this may happen, and you're signing this release saying you accept responsibility. So it happened. You already signed the lease. The release.
Yeah. Now, whenever you're looking at a different law or code or statute or whatever your state or municipality calls it, a lot of times in the body of the text of the law at the very bottom, there'll be some little annotation which will have the date it is effective. It'll say like EFF and a colon and then the date. And it may even have more dates in there, and that'll generally track kind of the legislative history of that law and show you the different dates for the changes. So if you're ever out there and you're like have to look up a law or something like that, and you see the code section, if you look at the bottom, it'll tell you pretty much usually when the effective date is, just right there at the bottom. So it's a good little tidbit to know.
All right. I will do that when I'm looking through my law books.
Now, most of the incidences for lawsuits turn on when the accident happened or when the cause of action accrued. So, as I said, like if you had a case basically where the law allowed for punitive damages or allowed you to recover attorney's fees, but the law changes and the injury happens the day after, that can be obviously a huge deal, as we talked about, whenever the law comes into effect. So maybe, you know, in that instance, even if you win, maybe you have to win more than a certain amount in order to get your attorney's fees or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if it changed, that's something important to think about. So a case that might be really important as an attorney to get your attorney's fees back on might not be such a good case if it happened one day later.
Oh.
So sometimes it's very important to pay attention to these facts from the outset, not dive in head first on a case. So,
Well, you're not saying that would prejudice you and whether you'd want to take the case or not is how much money you could get. You're just standing up for the right?
Hey, I got to keep the lights on.
Until you meet Mr. Green, huh?
Well, I mean, if there's a case and I like this guy's damages are, you know, $100 and I sign him up on a contingency case where I get a third of that and I have to spend 3 weeks of my life working on it, it doesn't make financial sense to do that. Now, if there's an attorney's fees provision where I get all my attorney's fees if I get him his $100, then it makes sense.
Well, I would say that the best thing is don't take it on a contingency and then see if it's worth it to him.
Well, but, you know, your average Joe out there, he's not going to pay you $30,000 in attorney's fees to try to win $100 unless there is some sort of attorney's fees provision.
Yeah.
So.
That's true. That's one of the things, though, that I think stymies a lot of lawsuits.
What's that?
Is that they're not contingency type things, so people don't pursue them because it's not worth it. You don't have money. Corporations have money. They've got people already on retainer that are there that can represent them. So when you go up against them, you know, you're the only one that has anything at stake. The company doesn't have too much at stake.
Right. Well, and you think about it too, your average person can't shell out these attorney fees.
Exactly.
So it comes on an attorney to take it on a contingency basis, and they're going to have to sink a lot of time in it on essentially a gamble that they're going to get this.
It's a David and Goliath type situation.
It totally is. So there's some really good movies out there that show you this kind of dynamic. I think one was A Civil Action. It had John Travolta in there and Robert Duvall and things like that. And
that's where I like to get my legal knowledge, from movies and TV.
Yeah, it's a good place to do it sometimes. But it showed like the lawyer.
And podcast.
John Travolta and his partners, they took on, they took on this larger corporation, and basically they had to like mortgage and leverage their own personal homes and everything in order to try to win this lawsuit because they were taking it on such a risk. So, So anyway, it's very important to pay attention to when the cause of action accrues and what law you're looking at.
So, as being the lawyer, but also as being the one that thinks you have a case on something too, huh?
Yeah, because you think you might have a case, but if the law doesn't say so, you don't.
This is true. The law has the last word. Now, I have found a couple of instances where this ex post facto law has been challenged.
Oh, we were talking about that's constitutionally not allowed?
Right. Okay. Even though it's constitutionally not allowed, I found a couple of occasions where it has been challenged. This one involved a guy named Marvin Pugh. I'll say his name is P-E-U-G-H.
Mm-hmm.
And he was convicted of fraud for actions that occurred from 1999 through 2000. So at the time that he did that, the only sentencing guidelines in place were from 1998.
Okay.
But as in these things, the case took a while. And so I think it was like 2010 before it was finally settled. Well, there were new guidelines that came out in 2009. So the judge, in passing the sentencing, there was no doubt that he was guilty.
Right.
But it didn't change whether he committed a crime or not. Just changed what the sentencing guidelines were.
It was always a crime.
Yeah. So the 98, it was 37 to 46 months. In 2009, when it came out, it was 70 to 87 months. So this judge sentenced him to 70 months. And that was under the 2009 guidelines. So they said, wait a minute. That's a case of the ex post facto law there. You got to go by those other guidelines and cut it back down to within the 46 months was the high end of the other one.
Yeah.
And so it went to a circuit court to make a decision as to whether that was right or not. And they came back and said that it was okay for him to do that because that was guidelines are merely a suggestion. And judges have the freedom to decide based on the case and the severity of the crime and everything else, what to do as far as sentencing.
Yeah.
So they actually upheld it that it was legal to do.
Well, I mean, that makes sense, too, because, you know, it was a law. That it was against the law to do what he did.
Right.
When he did it.
That's it was just a question of
that. That sentence sounded very truncated in my head as I said it. But, yeah, it was a question of what the sentence was. So I can see why that would make sense to come down on that. And, you know, your average criminal, when they're doing these things, they're not even cognizant of what the actual penalty is, probably.
No, they don't know.
It doesn't take it into consideration.
Mm.
So, I mean, and we're not talking about...
So that would have had no influence on whether he did that crime or not.
Probably not. I think that really gets at the heart of what that law is about, or what that constitutional prohibition is about, is that we don't want somebody thinking like, well, that's not against the law, and they do it. And then 2 years later, they get arrested for it because, oh, we decided that is against the law. So now you're going to have to spend some time in prison or something like that. You know, it's a... there's some movie, I forget what it was. He goes, was that against the law? Because I got to tell you, if I had known it or seen a sign, I sure wouldn't have done it.
I've seen that. I don't know what... I can't recall right off the top of my head, but I've seen that.
Yeah.
Was that against the law? Was that wrong?
I think that might be a Costanza, a George Costanza.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I think it was when he had... relations with the cleaning woman.
Well, now that was a different one. There was one that was against the law, but that one was a different one.
Yeah.
Was that against the rules?
Because I got to tell you.
I didn't know. Nobody ever specifically said that. All right, now I've got another one. Stegner v. California. Remember that one? 2003?
Yeah, the old Stegner case.
That went to the Supreme Court. Now, that had to do with, in 1994, the California State Legislature enacted specific statute of limitations for child sexual abuse crimes, allowing charges to be filed within 1 year of the time that the crime was reported to police. It allowed when prior limitations period was expired, criminal prosecution on child molestation charges many years after its occurrence. So at the time, before that, it was a 3-year statute of limitations.
Okay.
If you didn't report this crime within 3 years of its happening, statute of limitations had run out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they said was, they changed the law in 1994 because they wanted it. They wanted to be able to go back. They had these repressed memory things,
yeah,
where people came forward and said, hey, 20 years ago, my father molested me or something like that. And they wanted to be able to prosecute these people for what they'd done.
Yeah.
So the California, they said, when you report it to police, you have 1 year from the time you report it to police. So, okay, that makes it ex post facto. You know, that you're going back in time and reaching back in. Well, in 1998, petitioner Marion Stegner was indicted for molesting for acts committed between 1955 and 1973. Under California's specific statute of limitations, it occurred after Stegner's two sons were both charged with molestation. During their state's investigation of one of the sons, Stegner's daughter reported that their father sexually abused them for years when they were under the age of 14. The grand jury found probable cause to charge Stegner with molestation of his two daughters. So, in other words, they asked the daughters later, why didn't you report this? They said they lived in fear of him,
yeah,
that he would have killed them if they reported it, so they never said anything. So what the state of California tried to do was come back and charge him with those crimes, even though they were, you know, 30 years prior, because they had just found out about him. Well, this went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can't take that law and go back. So it's only good for anything that's happened after 1994. It doesn't go back before 1994. You can't retroactively go back because the law wasn't in effect then that made it permissible to do that. Now, I don't like that. I don't think that's right. If you find out a guy's a child molester, I mean, to me, that's about the worst crime there is. And he deserves the worst punishment he can get. And to just say, well, the statute of limitations ran out, sorry, can't do anything about it, I don't think that's good enough. But it's like you said, move for summary judgment. The law is the law.
Yeah, I mean, there's some legal theory out there that says basically, not so much if they actually still had the memory or still knew that something took place, but if it's been like a repressed memory or something like that, there's some legal theory out there that argues that any statute of limitations should be told because they did not actually have the memory of the actual incident, the cause of action taking place. So basically, this would mean that the statute of limitations would actually not run during that time. It basically would start running whenever it was actually remembered.
Recalled
yeah. or remembered. Mm-hmm. That's kind of sometimes called the delayed discovery doctrine. And basically that means is that the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the plaintiff has discovered or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have discovered all the facts which are essential to the cause of action. So that's one theory that you can try to argue to get around that statute of limitations. And I think you're probably going to have better luck with that in a civil case as opposed to a criminal case because there's more constitutional protections in a criminal case with regard to that.
Well, and I guess in this case, that wasn't a repressed memory. They knew it, and they knew it happened. They just didn't say anything because they figured the father would kill them.
Yeah, which...
Which, there again, that seems like that shouldn't be legal.
Yeah, now if there were some overt threats by the father saying, hey, if you tell anybody about this, I'll kill you, then that kind of witness intimidation could be, well, number one, could be another crime in and of itself. But I think there's a legal argument, too, there that basically their failure to report it to the police should not be brought about or should not be punished, brought about by this guy's threats. So
true.
You know, I think if it's just like, well, he never said that, but we were just scared, then that's
we knew he would.
You might have other problems.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of an interesting area of law, though.
Now, I thought that it would be interesting. I looked at it on an international standpoint because, you know, I'm an international kind of guy.
Yeah, so, you're very European.
Yeah, I mean, we always talk a lot about, I mean, West Virginia law and, you know, laws in the United States. So I thought I would take this international and see how other countries looked at this ex post facto law. And majority of countries do have, either in their constitution or founding documents or whatever, something that does eliminate that from happening, same as United States.
Yeah, we don't. It's generally a good theory that you don't want to change the rules of the game in the middle of the game.
Right. However, there are some exceptions.
All right, who are they?
Well, and it is. Here's one: Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
In Hungary, in 2010, the parliament established a 98% punitive tax on any income over 2 million forints received either as a retirement package or as severance pay in the last 5 years of the government sector.
Yeah.
So they made a law and then went back and said, now this takes effect going back 5 years if you got this. Now, of course, they had financial problems. There was some corruption in the government and everything. So they were trying to recoup this money. So that was a law they passed. There might have been some innocent people caught in that, but that was a law they passed that took effect ex post facto.
What do you think about an ex post facto law that says any CEO that made over $70 million in the past 10 years.
Yes, I'm for it. I am for it. Yay. I vote as a yay. All right, now Australia. In Australia, they have no strong constitutional prohibition on ex post facto laws, although they do have narrowly retroactive laws. They might violate the constitutional separation of powers principle. Retroactive laws designed to prosecute what was perceived to have been a blatantly unethical means of tax avoidance were passed in the early 1980s by the Fraser government. Similarly, the retroactive effect of legislation criminalizing certain war crimes retroactively have been held to be constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
The government sometimes will make a press release that it intends to change the tax law with effect from the date and time of the press release before legislation is even introduced into Parliament. So they kind of put it in the newspaper, we're going to do this, and then go about passing it. Yeah. And if they pass it, it goes back to that date that they put it in the newspaper.
Well, they put you on notice.
Yeah. So that's a little bit different.
It is. I mean, I guess it's kind of just a different theory because you can do that faster.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I like that because, I mean, you could put anything in the paper, in the newspaper saying, hey, we're going to make it a crime to have chickens in your backyard. So everybody goes out and gets rid of all their chickens, but obviously...
Then it doesn't pass.
Yeah. Well, all these people got rid of their chickens.
Right.
I mean... They were counting on those chickens before their eggs hatched.
Now you know why they crossed the road.
Going the wrong way over there, too.
Now, in Germany, Article 103 of the German Basic Law requires that an act may be punished only if it has already been punishable by law at the time it was committed.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of goes back to the one that we were talking about. However, there were some scholars and politicians... that said that the Nuremberg trials following World War II were based on ex facto law because the Allies did not negotiate the London Charter defining crimes against humanity and creating the International Military Tribunal. It said that although the Nuremberg Charter, the procedural law under which the trials were held, post-dated VE Day, the tribunal rejected the defense that the criminal law was est post facto, arguing international criminal court establishment. You know, that was something I guess they tried to avoid the Nuremberg trials.
Well, I mean, I see the legal argument, and I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But in the ends of justice, I don't mind so much.
That's right. Well, you know, when does the right thing hold out? Now, here's Mexico. According to the first and second paragraphs of the Article 14th of the Mexican Constitution, retroapplication of the law is prohibited if it is on detriment of a person's right. But the new law can be applied if it benefits the person.
Yeah.
So you can have ex facto as long as it benefits the person, just not if it hurts them.
Exactamundo.
So I thought that was a little bit interesting. You know, we talk about victims having rights and not victims. We talk about criminals having rights and not the victims. Well, that kind of sounds like they're helping out the criminals.
Well, I think that makes sense. And there's a lot of talk about that, especially with marijuana laws. And if, you know, marijuana laws basically change and is decriminalized.
Should you let all the people out of prison that went to prison for marijuana?
Yeah. And I think you probably should. Because I think that
tends that's not a crime anymore. Yeah.
Well, it tends to show that, you know, as a society, we recognize that, hey, maybe people shouldn't be imprisoned or held culpable for these kinds of things. And
man, can you imagine how many people would be turned loose
for marijuana charges?
Yeah, because I mean, I don't have any kind of numbers, but you got to know that. I mean, that there's a lot of people in prison for marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any numbers either, so I'm just completely talking out of thin air here.
But it's got to be a lot.
I'm blowing smoke.
Maybe a buttload?
A buttload.
At least a buttload.
A metric buttload.
In the Netherlands, Article 4 of the Law on General Provisions, which has been in effect since 1838, states that the law has no retroactive effect. Article 1 of the criminal law states that no act is punishable without a pre-existing law, and that in the case an act was punishable, but the law was changed after the criminal act, the most favorable to the suspect of the two laws will apply.
That's similar to the Mexico rule.
Exactly.
You get the benefit, but not the bad part.
Right.
So I think that's probably a good, I like that.
Now, in Sweden, retroactive penal sanctions and other retroactive legal effects of criminal law, of criminal acts due to the state are prohibited by Chapter 2, Section 10 of the Instruments of Government. Retroactive taxes or charges are not prohibited, but they can have retroactive effect reaching back only to the time when a new tax bill was proposed by the government. The retroactive effect of a tax or charge thus reaches from that time until the bill is passed by Parliament. So they do allow it as long as it's for taxes and stuff, but not for criminal activity. Now, I thought this was also interesting. Here's one where it did apply that didn't have to do with taxes. The Swedish Act of Succession was changed in 1979, and the throne was inherited regardless of sex. The inheritance right was withdrawn from all the descendants of Charles the 14th. I can't read these numbers. I don't know. John something. Except the current king, Carl the 16th, Gustav. Thereby, the heir apparent title was transferred from the newborn Prince Carl Philip to his older sister, Crown Princess Victoria. Huh. So it changed the lines of inheritance retroactively. So this one guy, he's waiting in line. He's going to be the new king. Hey, sorry, we changed the law. Your sister's got it, or your aunt or whatever.
Not so fast there, kid.
Yeah.
You're now a duke.
Yeah. You're now the Duke of Sandwich.
The Duke of Sandwich?
Yeah.
I think you may be slightly off on that one.
All right. Now, I like this one. United Kingdom. Our good buddies in the United Kingdom.
That's the UK.
The UK. That's right. The unknown. In the United Kingdom, ex post facto laws are frowned upon, but are permitted by virtue of the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. Historically, all acts of Parliament before 1793 were ex post facto legislation, inasmuch as their date of effect was the first day of the session in which they were passed. This situation was rectified.
That's interesting.
This situation was rectified by the Acts of Parliament Commencement Act 1793. Some laws are still passed retroactively. The Pakistan Act of 1990, by which the United Kingdom amended its legislation consequent to the Commonwealth of Nations having readmitted Pakistan as a member, was one such law. Despite being passed on the 29th of June, 1990, Section 2, Subsection 3 states that this act shall be deemed to have come into force on the 1st of October, 1989, 9 months before it was enacted. Retrospective criminal laws are prohibited by Article 7 of the European Convention on Human Rights, to which the United Kingdom is a signatory. But several noted legal authorities have stated their opinion that parliamentary sovereignty takes priority even over this. For example, the War Crimes Act created an ex post facto jurisdiction of British courts over war crimes committed during the Second World War. Another important example of a case which shows the doctrine of parliamentary supremacy in action is Burma Oil Company Limited v. Lord Advocate, which retrospectively changed the law on compensation resulting from scorched earth actions in Burma during the war. More recently, the Police Detention and Bail Act of 2011 retroactively overrode a controversial court judgment resulting from an error in the drafting of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984 and would potentially have invalidated thousands of criminal convictions. Hmm. So they rely on that law of parliamentary sovereignty. Sovereignty, am I saying that correctly? Sovereignty.
Sovereignty?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
they're a sovereign nation.
That's right.
So they rely on that as their way of doing whatever they want to do, basically. So I thought it was funny, but it's generally frowned upon. It's back to the old Ross in the dating a student when he's a professor.
It's like
there's no law specifically forbidding it, but it's frowned upon.
It's like masturbation on an airplane.
It's not prohibited, but it's frowned upon?
It's my understanding.
I think you better check your passenger stub.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Brief.
Legal Brief is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms we talked about. And I usually quiz Tommy and see if he can remember
anything
or what they mean. Ex post facto. What does that mean?
That means after the fact.
That's right. And you talk about that in relation to laws, which we were just talking about very.
That means passing a law that changes something that happened before.
Exactly. And it's frowned upon.
It's forbidden in the United States. It's just frowned upon in the UK.
It is. It's
as long as you do it sovereignly, you're okay there.
It's constitutionally forbidden in the US, but frowned upon in other places.
That's right.
Cause of action. What does that mean?
Cause of action means the time when something took place, like an event took place, like an accident, or you harmed somebody, or a theft, or something like that. It was the date that it actually happened.
And the statute of limitations for a crime would, or a crime or a lawsuit would basically start running from that date.
Correct.
Because that's when the a cause of action is when the statute of limitations starts to run. The cause of action accrues on a certain date.
Right. Not from when you finally go to court or whatever.
Exactly.
Because that may be well after.
Now, here's a hard one.
Uh-oh.
When does West Virginia law take effect?
90 days after the legislature convenes. Not convenes, disembarks, or whatever they call it.
Says, I'll just read it because it is actually worded very strangely. No act of the I think you're right though. No act of the legislature shall take effect until the expiration of 90 days after its passage, unless the legislature shall, by a vote of 2/3 of the members elected to each house, taken by yeas and nays, otherwise direct.
So I think it's like 90 days after they finish, unless they take a vote to make it immediate.
Yeah. What law in West Virginia comes into effect on January 1st of 2018?
Voter ID law.
That's right.
Give me that 100.
And what does...
Oh, there's another one.
Oh, there's another one. What is an MSJ?
MSJ, that's a summary judgment.
You're missing one acronym there. Or one letter of the acronym.
Summary...
MSJ.
Summary judgment. Massive summary judgment.
I'm moving the court for a massive summary judgment.
I want a massive amount of money on this summary judgment.
No, it's a motion for summary judgment.
Oh, motion for summary judgment.
And essentially, a motion for summary judgment is proper whenever there's no question of facts. It's like pretty much a purely a legal argument. And the jury could only find in favor of one of the parties. So
I got TMJ. Does that count?
Tooth metal jacket.
Kind of like that. It's that thing where you grind your teeth at night.
Oh. Your CPAP doesn't have a...
And your jaw gets all funky.
Your CPAP doesn't have a setting for that?
No, it doesn't do anything for that. Well, you have to get a mouthpiece or something for that.
I bet it.
And my jaw pops around.
I bet a Sleep Number bed would help with that.
Can you hear that?
I have no direct correlation for that. Yeah, I can hear that.
That's my jaw popping.
I need you to stop.
I can gross. Do it all day long. That's what TMJ does to you. I've got PTSD from TMJ or whatever.
Well, that's going to do it for Legal Briefs. They're pretty good.
Well, you know, except for the motion on the ocean there. That was the only thing I missed.
Well, I think this is maybe coming to the end of an era for Court Appointed today. That's maybe our last episode we're doing here in the McElroy Studios.
That's true. We've been kicked out.
Kicked out?
We been kicked out. Out of the beautiful downtown McElroy Studios into the Smurl basement.
That's right. You have your own podcasting setup now.
Yes. Justin gave me my own setup. I don't know if it was just to get me out of his house or if he truly thought he was giving me a Merry Christmas. I'm not sure.
So from now on, we're going to be recording from Smurl Studios.
Yeah. We'll no longer be a part of McElroy Productions, I guess.
Well, still, it's a McElroy production.
They still claim us, don't they?
Still claim
us. On their McElroy shows.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
We do.
It was nice of them to have us out there at Candle Nights for a minute with their Sawbones.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. Got to see a lot of people.
Yeah. If you listen to the Sawbones live, when we're on there for just a few minutes.
We are. We get to talk about law stuff.
Yeah. To help them out.
Maybe.
Maybe. We hope. Well, Happy New Year, little buddy.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Tommy.
And Happy New Year to all our listeners. Thank you for listening to us for as long as you have. We appreciate all our dedicated listeners and, you know, spread the good word and maybe we'll keep it going for another year.
Yeah. Here's to a good and prosperous 2018 for everybody.
Pop the bottle.
I think that was your jaw.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.